Chapter 35. Sandecker pulled his car into the parking lot of the Alexandria College of Oceanography, climbed out from under the wheel, and walked over to a man standing beside an electric golf cart. Admiral Sandecker?
Yes.
Dr. Murray Silverstein. The round, balding little man stuck out his hand. Glad you could come, Admiral. I think we've got something that will prove helpful. Sandecker settled into the cart. We're grateful for every scrap of useful data you can give us. Silverstein took the tiller and guided them down an asphalt lane. We've run an extensive series of tests since last night. I can't promise anything mathematically exact, mind you, but the results are interesting, to say the least.
Any problems?
A few. The main snag that throws our projections from the precise side of the scale to the approximate is a lack of solid facts. For instance, the direction of the Titanic's bow when she went down was never established. This unknown factor alone could add 4 square miles to the search area.
I don't understand. Wouldn't a 45,000-ton steel ship sink in a straight line?
Not necessarily. The Titanic corkscrewed and slid under the water at a depressed angle of roughly 78 degrees, and as she sank, the weight of the sea filling her forward compartments pulled her into a headway of between 4 and 5 knots. Next, we have to consider the momentum caused by her tremendous mass and the fact that she had to travel 2.5 miles before she struck bottom. No, I'm afraid she landed on a horizontal line a fair distance from her original starting point on the surface. Sandecker stared at the oceanographer. How could you possibly know the precise angle of descent when the Titanic sank? The survivors' descriptions were, on the whole, unreliable. Silverstein pointed to a huge concrete tower off to his right. The answers are in there, Admiral. He stopped the cart at the front entrance of the building. Come along, and I'll give you a practical demonstration of what I'm talking about. Sandecker followed him through a short hallway and into a room with a large acrylic plastic window at one end. Silverstein motioned for the admiral to move closer. A diver wearing scuba equipment waved from the other side of the window. Sandecker waved back. A deep water tank, Silverstein said matter-of-factly. The interior walls are made of steel and rise 200 feet high with a diameter of 30 feet. There is a main pressure chamber for entering and exiting the bottom level, and 5 airlocks stationed at intervals along the side to enable us to observe our experiments at different depths.
I see, Sandecker said slowly.
You've been able to simulate the Titanic's fall to the sea floor. Yes, let me show you. Silverstein lifted a telephone from a shelf under the observation window. Owen, make a drop in 30 seconds.
You have a scale model of the Titanic?
Not exactly a prize exhibit for a maritime museum, of course, Silverstein said, but for a scaled-down version of the ship's general configuration, weight, and displacement, it's a near-perfect, balanced replica. The potter did a damned fine job.
The potter?
Ceramics, Silverstein said, waving his hand in a vague gesture. We can mold and fire 20 models in the time it would take us to fabricate a metal one. He laid a hand on Sandecker's arm and pulled him toward the window. Here she comes. Sandecker looked up and saw an oblong shape about 4 feet in length falling slowly through the water, preceded by what looked to be a shower of marbles. He could see that there had been no attempt to authenticate detail. The model looked like a smooth lump of unglazed clay, rounded at one end, narrowed at the other, and topped by 3 tubes representing the Titanic smokestacks. He heard a distinct clink through the observation window as the model's bow struck the bottom of the tank.
Wouldn't your calculations be thrown off by a flaw in the model's configuration? Sandecker asked.
Yes, a mistake could make a difference. Silverstein looked at him. But I assure you, Admiral, we missed nothing. Sandecker pointed at the model.
The real Titanic had 4 funnels. Yours has only 3.
Just before the Titanic's final plunge, Silverstein said. Her stern rose until she was completely perpendicular. The strain was too much for the guy wire supporting the number one funnel. They snapped, and it toppled over the starboard side. Sandecker nodded.
My compliments, Doctor. I should have known better than to question the thoroughness of your experiment.
It's nothing, really. It gives me a chance to show off my expertise. He turned and motioned a thumbs-up sign through the window. The diver tied the model onto a line that traveled toward the top of the tank. I'll run the test again and explain how we arrived at our conclusions.
You might begin by explaining the marbles.
They act the role of the boilers, Silverstein said.
The boilers?
Perfect simulation, too. You see, while the Titanic's stern was pointing at the sky, her boilers broke loose from their cradle mounts and hurtled through the bulkheads toward the bows. Massive things they were, 29 all told. Some of them were nearly 16 feet in diameter and 20 feet long.
But your marbles fell outside the model.
Yes. Our calculations indicate that at least 19 of the boilers smashed their way through the bows and dropped to the bottom separately from the hull.
How can you be sure?
Because if their fall had been contained, the tremendous shift in ballast caused by their journey from amidships to the forward section of the ship would have pulled the Titanic on a 90-degree course straight downward. However, the reports of the survivors watching from the lifeboats, for once most all tend to agree, state that soon after the ear-splitting rumble from the boiler's crazy stampede had died away, the ship settled back a bit at the stern before sliding under. This fact indicates to me, at any rate, that the Titanic vomited her boilers, and, once free of this superincumbency, righted herself slightly to attain the 78-degree slant I mentioned previously.
And the marbles bear out this theory?
To the letter. Silverstein picked up the telephone again.
Ready whenever you are, Owen.
He replaced the receiver on its cradle. Owen Dugan, my assistant above. About now, he'll be setting the model in the water directly over that plumb line you see in the water off to one side of the tank. As the water begins coming in through holes drilled strategically in the bows of the model, she'll begin to go down by the head. At a certain angle, the marbles will roll to the bow, and a spring-loaded door will allow them to fall free. As if on cue, the marbles began falling to the floor of the tank, followed closely by the model. It struck about 12 feet from the plumb line. The diver made a tiny mark on the bottom of the tank and held up his thumb and index finger, indicating 1 inch. There you have it, Admiral. 110 drops, and she's never touched down outside a 4-inch radius. Sandecker stared into the tank for a long moment, then turned to Silverstein.
So, where do we search?
After a few dazzling computations by our physics department, said Silverstein, our best guess is 1,300 yards south of east from the point the Sappho 1 discovered the Coronet. But at that, it's still a guess.
How can you be certain the horn didn't fall on an angle, too?
Silverstein feigned a hurt look.
You underestimate my genius for perfection, Admiral.
Our evaluations here would be worthless without a clear-cut picture of the Coronet's path to the seafloor. Included in my expense vouchers, you'll find a receipt from Moe's Pawn Shop for 2 Coronets. After a series of tests in the tank, we took them 200 miles off Cape Hatteras and dropped them in 12,000 feet of water. I can show you the charts from our sonar. They each landed within 50 yards of their vertical departure line.
No offense, Sandecker said equably. I have a sinking feeling, if you'll pardon the pun, that my lack of faith is going to cost me a case of Robert Mondavi Chardonnay 1984.
1981, Silverstein said, grinning.
If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a schmuck with good taste.
Think how common the world would be without us. Sandecker made no reply. He moved up to the window and stared inside the tank at the ceramic model of the Titanic. Silverstein moved up behind him.
She's a fascinating subject, no doubt of it.
Strange thing about the Titanic, Sandecker said softly. Once her spell strikes, you can think of nothing else.
But why? What is there about her that grips the imagination and won't let go?
Because she's the wreck that puts all the others to shame, Sandecker said. She's modern history's most legendary yet elusive treasure. A simple photograph of her is enough to pump the adrenaline. Knowing her story, the crew who sailed her, the people who walked her decks in the few short days she lived, that's what fires the imagination, Silverstein. The Titanic is a vast archive of an era we'll never see again. God only knows if it is within our power to bring the grand old dame into daylight again. But by heaven, we're gonna try.